This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 137, and I'm your host, Simon Bound. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Keith Thompson about his book, The UFO Paradox, The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Keith Thompson is an author, independent journalist, talk radio host, former TV talk show host, and former US Senate staff member. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Esquire, San Francisco Chronicle, Idaho Statesman, and the Pacific Sun. Hi, Keith. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Simon, it's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called The UFO Paradox, The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. And you say at the beginning that this book is an invitation to imagine the UFO phenomenon as a call from the cosmos. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that metaphorically, but sincerely, a call from the cosmos, meaning a call from the fabric of reality itself, the reality at large, to open our eyes and ears, to expand our maps of science and society. This is a phenomenon that doesn't show up in its full entirety according to the current maps of Western science, of course. And we can get into what's missing there. And in the current paradigm, this phenomenon is not supposed to be able to do all of the things that it does. I often say when the phenomenon was told how it should behave, apparently it didn't get the memo because it does not obey the strict Western scientific delineation or separation between the mental and the physical. So that's one issue. But a call from the cosmos, you know, William Butler Yeats had a beautiful statement, the great poet. He said, the world is full of magical things, patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper. So that's what I mean by by a call from the cosmos. It's an invitation to expand our perception, but also our, as I say, our maps, our theories to account for this kind of phenomenon, because it happens. These events happen, as we now know, the near-death phenomenon has been quite well established as by scientific experiment, or I should say scientific measurement and scientific inquiry. It's not supposed to be able to be the case that these events happen. So, and the same with the paranormal in general. The paranormal doesn't officially make sense according to the Western model, but once again, the paranormal apparently didn't get the memo. So I'm in favor when there's a significant disparity between a coherent and congruent set of data that points to an area of life that is real, that interacts with real people, and that phenomenon doesn't show up on the maps of society, the official theories of science, then at some point it makes sense to take a look at the maps and say, hey, have we updated our maps lately? Oh, look, they're kind of out of date, in the same sense as when the explorers from Spain came to the New World in 15th century. And they even then had maps of the ocean with lines and arrows saying, beyond this point, there be sea serpents. Well, that's kind of what, even though we fancy that we're much more rational at this point, our maps of science kind of point out there and say, oh, UFOs, well, they don't really happen. They're mistaken identity and they're hoaxes and hallucinations. But my book is filled with evidence that something is going on and it's time to kind of look more deeply.
So it's kind of like UFOs are the modern sea serpents.
Yeah, it's what's beyond there. It's a little bit like I describe in the book, the great pioneering astronomer Galileo did his computations in his room and also used a device called a telescope, which was a novel invention. And he put the computations together with what he empirically observed, and he began to spread word. Wait a minute, we got it backwards. The Earth orbits the sun. not the other way around. Well, before long, he began getting knocks on the door from the religious authorities, who were at that time, as you know, were in charge of, they were the authorities on matters that are considered scientific. And so the Vatican came to pay him a visit and said, Signor Galileo, no, stop saying that. It's not true. And he said, well, you don't have to take my word for it. Come look at my computations here and also have a look through my telescope. And it's famously, they said, no, we're not going to look through your telescope. They actually refused to avail themselves of the very device and the very way of measurement that would have allowed them, if they had been willing, to confirm what he saw with his eye and also what his computations found, which is also what Copernicus had found. They said, if you keep saying this, we're going to put you in house arrest. He kept saying it, and they put him under house arrest for the rest of his life, which is probably an improvement over burning at the stake, which is what happened to other scientists who dared at that era to claim and to make sincere hypotheses that the world was different than had been imagined.
I suppose in a way we could almost compare how the Vatican felt with how some people feel today, in that I think for the Vatican, they were kind of trying to protect the Catholic, I'll say, worldview or universe view, that the earth was the center of the universe. It was created by God and is special, and everything revolves around it. And Galileo was saying, no, we're just a planet revolving around a star, and there's many, many stars. And for people in the Catholic Church, this would have been what you might call a paradigm shift or ontological shock. And it was too much of a shock that they had to clamp down on it. And I think maybe there are some people around today who view UFOs in that way.
That's actually a big part of my premise in the book, Simon. The one reversal that has happened is now the role that was played by the Vatican then is in many respects and very often played by the scientific community, which, you know, with the scientific community had stood up to the Catholic Church. And I don't mean to emphasize just the Catholic Church, but at that time, the church was the Catholic Church, you know, the Protestant response was happening as well. But anyway, just could speak of the church. But now the tables have turned, and very often this knee-jerk debunker stance is assumed by people who are speaking in the name of science, but they're very often not acting scientifically. They're acting from an almost faith-based premise. And the faith-based premise is that ours is a material universe consisting only of matter that is not really alive. It's the molecules are small particles that spin in orbit, and it's completely random. There's no purpose. It's essentially dead matter. But somehow, and this is what materialism fails to resolve, somehow this dead matter at some stage magically organized itself into consciousness, subjectivity, the sense that it is something like it. There's something that it is like for Keith to be Keith. There's something it is like for Simon to be Simon. That is really the definition. That's the most basic experience of consciousness, the sense that I am. There's something it is like to be me right now speaking these words. My eyes are open, my ears are open. I'm conscious. And that is actually a miracle, in my view. I would use the word miracle advisedly. But the astonishing thing is we're looking to explain how did consciousness emerge out of dead matter. Maybe that's a non sequitur. Maybe the question gets it backward. How did we overlook the basic fact of consciousness, which is what stares at us in the mirror every morning when we wake up or when we open our eyes in the morning? We're here. We exist. We know that we are. So these are the questions that I think the UFO phenomenon actually brings into view, because there are aspects of the phenomenon that on the one hand act like material or physical events, show up on radar, leave ground indentations, leave burn marks, have temperature measurements, have geologic location in space very consistent with a physical object, and yet in the next phase these same objects will very often divide into two or three ships with different densities, some extremely opaque, others translucent with light shining through. And then those will often disperse into orbs of light, different colors, and sink into the ground. Well, whatever that is, it doesn't behave like physicality as we know it. So it's a phenomenon that is physical in some respects and is psychic in other respects. And that does call for a paradigm shift.
Yeah, and it's that thing that's, I don't know if you could say it's confusing. It's like you're saying there's physical parts to it, and then there's other parts to it that seem maybe interdimensional or ethereal, or I don't know which word you use. So it's like so difficult to examine in a way, because you can't really pin it down in either of those places.
It's a little bit like the reason I bring in the Greek god Hermes, who in Latin, in the Roman pantheon of gods, is Mercury. Well, what is Mercury? You open up, if you break a thermometer, apart from the physical danger that can provide to your health, you break a thermometer and you see what happens to the liquid lead. It's called quicksilver. It disperses into tiny balls. You've got to be very careful how you clean it up. But metaphorically, the phenomenon is very much like quicksilver, very much like Hermes, the messenger god who would say one thing and do another, and was constantly known as a trickster phenomenon, similar to the Native American and other indigenous mythological figures like Raven and Crow. I think it's valuable to study the coyote or trickster myths from the annals of folklore and mythology, frankly, to get a better sense of those kinds of phenomena that outdistance our attempts to put them in one category or another. Rationality likes to divide things into binary. It's either true or not true, real or symbolic, physical or material. This is a phenomenon that raises its hand and says, I vote for all of the above, and I appear on my terms. And if I confound you, this is what I believe, Simon. I think this is the phenomenon. When I say intent, I want to be very careful. I can't say what the intent of the phenomenon is. But if the phenomenon were setting out with an intention to subvert our categories, to challenge our certainty that it is either A or B, If its intent were to do that, it's succeeding. It is, if one researcher called the UFO an agent of cultural deconstruction. What he meant by that was this phenomenon, in the very way it appears, namely so ludicrous as to be dismissed by the agents of official culture in science and academia, and yet deeply experienced as deeply real and life transforming in the experience of the witnesses. It is as if that very disparity in how it's received is intended to subvert, to reorganize, to get us out of a kind of trance. That's what I mean when it's by a call from the cosmos. In various spiritual traditions, there are different calls to prayer or worship or meditation. Sometimes there's a bells are rung. Sometimes there's a gong that is chimed. Sometimes other kinds of noise making that call the community. Oh, it is time to come to prayer, time to come to worship, time to go to the meditation hall. And what that sound is meant to indicate, it's time for a different mode of awareness. Now we go and we quiet down, we enter a contemplative mode, and we, you know, do what our faith tradition summons us to do. I don't put the UFO phenomenon in a faith tradition, but I use the analogy of that call to prayer or call to a greater awareness as what I think this phenomenon is really about. It is as if it's trying to, precisely because it doesn't officially exist, and yet it unofficially exists in the lives of real people.
So it's almost like, would you say, it's like if you see a UFO, that's not an accident. It's being presented to you on purpose, as almost like if you're on a spiritual path and you're taking all these little baby steps. And by seeing the UFO, that's another step on your path. And they're doing that to you on purpose. It's like I heard the UFO researcher saying, it's like they're giving you a slap on the ass and saying, hey, pay attention.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. As I said, if it weren't its intent, if that were not actually its intent, it certainly could make a very good case that that's what it's trying to do. That brings me, let me segue from there to the most famous case in America, or one of the most famous cases, was the sighting by a pilot in the northwestern part of the United States in 1947, near Mount Rainier in the state of Washington. Kenneth Arnold was a private pilot with a lot of experience. He was out looking for a downed plane for the Forest Service. He would have gotten a reward if he had found the downed plane. I don't even know if he ever did. But what he saw instead, and when I say instead, he saw, not expecting it, he saw nine objects flying in formation over the mountain. He was a very skilled pilot. He was able to clock them very quickly. He knew how fast they were going, and they were going at speeds that were not comparable to anything he would expect to see in the sky. He called into the airport, says, "Well, what's going on up here? Do you have nine objects?" And they said, "No, not from where we're looking." He said, "Well, there's whatever they are, they're skipping the way plates would skip over water." And so he was referring to the motion, but that instantly got translated a little bit mistakenly by a reporter who was listening into the radio broadcast and drove to the airport and waited for Kenneth Arnold to land. He said, "What the heck did you say you saw, sir? You say you saw flying saucers." Well, that's what got reported. He said he saw objects moving like saucers, but in fact, he was reported as saying they were shaped like saucers. So there's an interesting point to notice, a little small detail in the original story. But more amazingly, about this sense of a calling, about this sense that the event seems to be tailored for the individual, as astonishing as that is, you know, events in the world are not supposed to be tailored to us personally. Inanimate objects, anyway, are not supposed to be. Western science says we're the subject. We use our observation powers, and objects are out there, and objects can't influence us in any way, certainly not psychically. Well, so what happened is he went home that night after landing, after talking with media all day and realizing he'd become a public figure, and that was not his intent. He told when he went home that day, something happened in the house that was astonishing. And for a period of time, orbs of light began to appear in the house, or balls of light, similar to what people report with the UFO phenomenon. But this was, he had seen the objects in the state of Washington. He flew home that day to the state of Idaho. He lived in Boise. So this phenomenon, you might say, followed him home. It was a hitchhiker effect. And more than that, after Kenneth Arnold passed away, his daughter said, "My father wanted to wait until he was gone for me to reveal the rest of his story. He was always surprised," she said. His daughter, Kim Arnold, said, "My father was always surprised and perplexed by the idea that that day in 1947, he had seen nine ships made of metal, nuts and bolts, technological craft from some other part of the universe. That wasn't what he reported that day. He said that he saw these objects as glowing and having different densities. Some of them, they were blue and white light, quite luminous. And the densities were anywhere from very opaque to very translucent. And they seemed to beat, according to Kenneth Arnold, as his daughter said, they seemed to beat like the human heart, like a human heartbeat. He implied that they seemed to be living or to be conscious. And one more thing, he told his daughter, "I can't explain this, Kim, but it was as if I had a very deep sense these were from another dimension, not from outer space, but another dimension closer to us than we understand, possibly related to where we go when we leave this world." In other words, these were, in some sense, were a message from the beyond. From death, if you will. And when I found this out and brought it into the book, this is a fundamental shift in the defining story, the creation story of the UFO phenomenon. You can imagine how different you can imagine certainly it would have been a different start for the UFO phenomenon if Arnold had been willing, and I can understand why he wasn't willing to give the full report. that he saw nine objects that seemed to be living and breathing and had the beat of a human heart. With that kind of a report in 1947, they probably would have asked for his pilot's license and told him he needed to take a psychiatric exam before he got back in the plane. So he kept that to himself. But so what he was basically saying was he was not describing an extraterrestrial event. He was describing what theologians in religion call an eschatological event, which is a big $25 word for the events in life which are final events, ultimate events, related to spirituality, related to where we go after death, related to matters of the soul and spirit and purpose. So if the UFO phenomenon had gotten off on that footing, we might have always viewed this as an esoteric phenomenon rather than extraterrestrial. It isn't to say that this doesn't mean that they weren't from outer space, but that particular framework, the outer space close encounters of the third kind narrative, has become the most popular interpretation. But it's not necessarily, given the paranormal dimensions, it's not necessarily the most accurate frame for describing what goes on.
I wanted to ask you about something else in the book where you say the phenomenon suggests a co-creative context that joins the observer and the observed. Does that kind of mean that if you're expecting to see a flying saucer, you'll see a saucer, but if you're expecting a triangle, you'll see a triangle?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, with the Kenneth Arnold case, he said the objects flew like saucers if they were skipped over water. He didn't say he saw flying saucers. It was interesting. An observer at the time, not an actual witness, but a writer, subsequently wrote, he said, "I find it quite interesting that these extraterrestrials changed the shape of their craft to match a misreported detail put forward by a reporter." In other words, this writer was simply saying, rather ironically, this reporter got it wrong when he said they were shaped like flying saucers. That isn't what Kenneth Arnold said. But when it was reported that they were shaped like flying saucers inaccurately, people began to see flying saucers. So that's why he said, what is it about this phenomenon that would cause it to change its shape just to match what people expected? Well, he said that ironically and a little bit sarcastically. But in fact, there is a quality, a shape-shifting quality to this. It is a very open question, Simon, as to whether the state of consciousness of a particular observer in some sense interprets this phenomenon according to expectation. Because let's say, you know, we acknowledge three dimensions of space, one of time. The four-dimensional reality is what our official science works on in terms of the time-space framework. But in string theory right now, one of the divisions of physics, there is speculation that there are anywhere between 11 and 26 dimensions. So what if the three dimensions of space and time are not? What if there are more dimensions? These phenomena could be from anywhere. They could be from the past. They could be from the future. And that's not just science fiction. That's as plausible, given what we're learning from quantum physics and other speculative developments in science. So yeah, that idea of a co-creative context, it's as if the witness and the phenomenon bring each other into coexistence for the moment of the sighting. It's very wild. It's a little bit like the genre of movie that where you may or may not be familiar with the category, magical realism. Magical realism are those movies and novels in which ordinary reality is occasionally punctuated by magical events, that magic is kind of built into the seams of reality. For example, the famous American movie Field of Dreams. A farmer is out in his cornfield in Iowa, and he hears a voice. "If you build it, they will come." And he calls to his wife. "Well, what did you say?" "I didn't say anything." "Well, what was that voice?" "Oh, you're hearing voices now, are you?" Well, if you're familiar with the movie, it leads to one remarkable, surreal happening after another. The same with Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. The Latin American authors are quite hip to this ability to bring the magical into reality, not with the exaggerated gestures of Harry Potter, where the whole thing is fantastical. Every dimension of Harry Potter is fantastic, fantastical, and surreal. But in magical realism, the events come into ordinary reality and then slip away again and then come back in again. And I think that is how the UFO phenomenon actually functions, according to that kind of a framework.
You say in the book that you came to be open to this kind of thinking because of your own experiences. Can you tell us what happened when you were in your teens, where you had a, I don't know what you call it, an awakening experience?
Yeah, I did. My first orientation was as a classroom student, and I gave a current events report one day in a class. So that was my opening gambit as a, you might say, as a young journalist, 12 years old. But on a personal level, 2 years later, I had, at age 14, with no expectation, no training, no predisposition, as far as I could tell, I had gone up. We had in our house, we had a TV antenna, an old style TV antenna that was actually a physical structure that was built into the ground, and it adjoined our roof. So against our parents' wishes, we would occasionally climb up the TV antenna and get access to the sloping roof. It was fairly dangerous, but there was a way to get out on the roof and find a quiet place. I used to love, as a teenager, to go out on the roof of our house when my parents weren't there to discourage it or to say absolutely no. And one day I went out on the roof in that manner and simply lay back in a little cubby that I found I could do. It was a beautiful day, probably spring or summer, the blue sky. And I looked into the sky. It isn't that I saw anything in the sky. That's not where this story is leading. But I looked into the sky with no purpose or aim, very soft focus. And in a matter of a second, I suddenly felt as if I was everywhere at once, but no place in particular, no place specific. I felt a sense of being present at every point, as if I could be present at every point of existence. I felt lifted as if beyond time and space, although that phrase didn't occur to me. That was my experience. It was a sense of a brilliant illumination. And in that moment, I don't know how long it lasted, Simon. And by the way, it had the sense not of being startling or disturbing. It was astonishing, but not disturbing, because it was, I felt, this is the truth. I'm seeing the way things are with a kind of boundless spaciousness that we don't see because we are too focused on the events in our lives, our thoughts, our sensations, our perceptions, our beliefs about who we are. In that moment, I felt the background of all of that. So needless to say, I didn't come down that day. Oh, one more thing. I came down with an absolute conviction. Again, 14 years old. So I'm channeling this through an undeveloped, you know, a young, still developing mind, but at a moral or spiritual level, you might say, I felt no doubt this universe, this world is teeming with purpose, with meaning, value. It's that inherently existence is filled with purpose. I didn't know what that meant, except that I knew that had to include me and it had to include everybody else. So I came back that day. I didn't go inside to the house. And when my mom said, "What did you do this afternoon, Keith?" I didn't tell her I had experienced the end of division between my identity and the whole universe. I didn't say anything like that. And I didn't have language for a spiritual experience because our family, we were nominal churchgoers, Episcopalian, but we were not devout. It was more that it was good for good people to be seen going to church, rather than any deep convictions we had. So I didn't tell anybody about this. Instead, I began to look into, when I'd go to the library, as I loved doing anyway, in addition to reading history and politics and biographies, I began to pick up books on the spiritual, metaphysical philosophy shelf. And I began to sense, oh, that experience that I had was what people talk about as mystical. And I learned to live kind of a secret life, part of me in touch with this deeper sense of meaning and purpose and always on the lookout for others who might be in on this secret, which is actually an open secret. And I oscillated between that kind of an identity and just my normal identity as a seemingly separate individual with friends, playing kickball and softball and getting interested in dating and all of the things that a normal human being does. There was a kind of a split existence, but it wasn't an uneasy split. It was just that I knew that there was a larger game. I can think once my father one time, I think it was at the dinner table, looked at me and he simply asked, "What are you smiling about?" And I had this habit as a result of this experience. When I was just feeling peaceful, I would sit there and reflect on this sense that I had seen something that was available to everybody else too. And I just wish they could see this someday, realize that the backdrop of all the existence is far richer than we know. And I said to my dad, I said, "Oh, I was just thinking of something amusing." He said, "Okay." But I was in on a kind of private joke, if you will. So what's that got to do with the UFO phenomenon? I studied this phenomenon after having given a report in my sixth grade class about a sighting. And my teacher, as a result of my giving this current events report in the class, came forward at the end. And when the students had been asking me questions like, "Well, do you think it's from outer space? If it wasn't swamp gas that the people saw, what was it?" And that referred to the fact that one explanation of a sighting in the state of Michigan in the United States was explained away as the luminosity that is sometimes seen near a swamp due to swamp gas. So a student said to me, "Well, if it wasn't swamp gas, what was it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but swamp gas does not sound like a very good explanation." And that's when my teacher came forward and said to the class, "I think what Keith is trying to tell us about this UFO thing is that it's important with phenomena like this to keep an open mind and ask relevant questions, not to reach conclusions right away." Simon was like, wow. It wasn't that she had rescued me in that moment. She had heard me. She had seen me. She had acknowledged me as a young adult, an aspiring adult, as if I had something to contribute. So it was a very good experience for me. By the way, she concluded my presentation to the class. She said, "Mr. Thompson," she referred to me by my whole name, "Mr. Thompson, that was a fine report. You have the makings of a journalist or maybe a scientist, possibly even a detective." And then she closed with, "Follow the clues wherever they lead." And Simon, that has been my approach. I decided not on that day to become a UFO investigator. That certainly wasn't my goal as a 12-year-old. I was eager to get back on the playground, in 10 minutes. But at some level, I continued to pay attention to this phenomenon, and I did so with my teacher's permission. Follow the evidence wherever it leads. And that's been my approach, and that's what this book is a manifestation of.
And having had that experience, you were more open-minded to the high strangeness, the really weird stuff that a lot of UFO researchers were kind of rejecting, and they just wanted to stick with the nuts and bolts.
That's it. That's exactly right. And after my 14-year-old experience on the roof, I actually had moments in which I was aware of what was going on in a situation in a way that I did not know how I was aware. In other words, in intuition. I think that experience help break down the wall. I think we're all possessed of psychic capacities. Certain members of our species, are particularly gifted, and they're even brought in by police officers to help solve cases. But I believe intuitive abilities, psychic abilities, telepathy, clairvoyance, and precognition, and even psychokinesis in some cases are widely distributed, but they're not noticed, because of our rational bias is so strong, and these traits are not really necessary for survival much of the time, and they're not highly necessary to develop. But I think as a result of this experience, or maybe in addition to this experience on my family rooftop, I found myself at times intuitively in touch with situations. And my friends would say, "How did you know that?" I said, "Oh, just a lucky guess." because I had part of my intuition, Simon, was that I did not want to draw attention to myself. I don't mean to say that I was a prodigious psychic or anything of that kind. I didn't have a particularly well-developed psychic gift. But I think many of us, if we would just stop and admit that when we pick up the phone and we've been thinking about a friend who we haven't heard from since, you know, elementary school, grade school, or middle school, or college, I haven't heard from them for 20 years. And we've been, you know, we make a note of that. I wonder whatever happened to her. And we pick up the phone, and it's that person. And the person will say, "Hey, Keith, it's me from 10th grade, the algebra class. I've been thinking about you. I decided to look you up." Well, we've all had those moments. The moments when we're in the grocery store and we think behind us, somebody's staring at me. And you look behind, not really abruptly, but you look behind and you see someone is staring. They're probably doing it absentmindedly. So you smile and they smile. It isn't what was going on in the exchange that matters. It's that somehow you knew you were being stared at. And in fact, there are some now very good psychic studies that have been done at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, in particular in Northern California. Dr. Dean Radin set up a laboratory where he could measure. I won't put in out all the protocols of the study, but he found a way that people could stare at another person by closed circuit TV. Using closed circuit TV, the camera focused on the person to be stared at, and at certain intervals, the person who was staring was told to stare at the screen, stare at the person who's sitting there and reading a book. And during the time that the staring began and ended, the person's physiology, the person who was being stared at, their physiology was being measured. And there were statistically significant examples of their body registering that they knew they were stared at. They didn't know it consciously necessarily, but their body subliminally through heartbeat or galvanic skin response. So anyway, that's why my book is as much about the paranormal as it is about UFOs, because I think they're part and parcel. They're cut from the same cloth.
What do you make of the abduction phenomenon? Because that gets very strange. And even people reporting, it seems like their consciousness was abducted and their body stayed where it was.
Exactly. You know, this is such a complex one. J. Allen Hynek was an astronomer who was brought in by the Pentagon from Ohio State University to deal with the early UFO reports. And he died in more than a decade ago. But before he did, I talked with him, did a phone interview with him when he was retired. And I said, you know, you were at the very beginning of the UFO phenomenon. You saw the original sightings of events in the sky. Craft, parent craft that would then disappear in plain sight. You recorded landings. And then suddenly there were these cases of abduction. What did you feel as a researcher, as a credible astronomer who was committed to following the evidence wherever it leads? How did you feel when the abductions came on? And he laughed. He said, "Mr. Thompson, I'll be honest with you, my original response is, oh, that's just great." And he was being ironic because he said, "We're having a hard enough time conveying the legitimacy of these reports of events seen in the sky. Now they are interacting with people, according to reports, and even taking them ostensibly against their will." And this is what is reported, that people have especially pulled out of their beds at night or taken out of their cars and taken into waiting craft. So we can get to that in a moment. But back to what Hynek said, I said, did you ever have any doubt about your obligation to follow these reports? He said, never. He said, "I would have frankly wished they hadn't happened. It would have been a lot easier if we could just talk about things seen in the sky by eyewitnesses and radar. But it would never have occurred to me and my colleague, Dr. Jacques Vallée, who was a very famous, is still a famous researcher in his 80s now, maybe older." He said, "It never occurred to us that we would simply ignore these or rule them off the table as if they were out of bounds simply because they were so startling and challenging. That is not the way science works. We don't have the privilege of choosing the phenomena we want to study." So as for the abductions, There are viewpoints ranging from the claim that they are in fact hard-edged, real-world, physical takings. People are taken away and brought back after being experimented with, according to their reports. There are even reports that they are taking genetic material and fashioning a hybrid species, as fantastical as that sounds. Then there are researchers who say these, what if these are more, given the fugitive nature of the phenomenon, the fact that people say they are levitated out of their homes, and often there are not witnesses, although in some cases there are said to be witnesses. It's, again, ambiguous. Often the data are ambivalent. But given that quality, there are some researchers who say these are seem to be happening almost in a parallel reality, a kind of neighboring universe that under certain circumstances appears and overlaps with our reality and creates the a simulation that is as real as watching a car drive down the street. So I'm not taking a stand on explaining the abductions. It is a very provocative enigma, and I'm simply more interested in what people experience. And I have talked with people, gotten to know a good many people who have had the abduction experience or who simply define themselves as experiencers, some of whom are quite traumatized by the encounters. But in other cases, they are not strictly speaking abductions. They are more like visitations. And there's an interaction on with a kind of mutuality. So it runs the gamut from being something like a hard-edged kidnapping to more like an encounter between two different species with different understandings of what's real.
And you talk about Professor John Mack in the book, who was the professor of psychiatry at Harvard, and he did a lot of research on this and wrote great books on it. He worked with Bud Hopkins as well, and he talked to David Jacobs. But the sentence that stood out for me in your book was when he said, "I'm struck by the fact that there seems to be a kind of matching of the investigator with the experiencer. It's like something weird is going on."
Yes, it's as if the researchers like Bud Hopkins, who's no longer around, and David Jacobs, one of Hopkins' proteges who is retired, both of them are researchers who really took the view that these are not paranormal events. These are hard-edged physical events that are resembling kidnappings. These are intruders. In fact, that was the name of Bud Hopkins' book. And so some observers began to notice, it's interesting that Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs seem to find abductees who are always traumatized and always feel deeply violated. And in other words, a kind of matching of what Hopkins and Jacobs believed, almost as if, and I make a case that in Jacobs' situation, he almost seemed to encourage, he would discourage people. He would not want to work with witnesses, with abductees who claimed to speak of the Space Brothers, or who described out-of-body experiences, or described psychic experiences, because he himself did not believe in psychic experiences. Ironically, he believed abductions were real events, but he said, "Oh, I don't believe there's much evidence for the so-called psychic realm." I remember when Bud Hopkins told me that, I had to kind of lift my jaw back off the floor, because I was very familiar with over 100 years of established psychical research, especially the British Society for Psychical Research. Frederick Myers did a marvelous work and was extremely skeptical, did his best to rid the field of credulous, phony cases, to focus on the real stuff. So to say that you don't think that psychic phenomena, the paranormal, is confirmed, and you want to leave that stuff out, there's a huge selection bias that goes on where, so it's as if Hopkins and Jacobs tended to draw people to their theory. Whereas Mack, interestingly, had come to California, gotten to know Dr. Stanislav Grof, a psychiatrist who had pioneered at one point in the scientific and legitimate study of psychedelic drugs, especially LSD. And he later developed a method of of internal exploration of the psyche called holotropic breathwork, which, as you may know, is a practice where a person is on their back on the floor with a sitter sitting next to them to helping to guide them. And they're instructed to increase the rate of their breathing while they're listening to evocative music. And it tends to lead to an expanded state of consciousness and to a deeper awareness than most psychological methods can get to. So John Mack had had the opportunity to try out this method. He was trained as a conventional Freudian materialist. Frankly, he was raised by atheist parents, so he never gave any serious consideration to spirituality or non-ordinary realities of any kind and had not studied psychical phenomena. But when he began to do this breath work, holotropic, which is a word that means essentially moving toward wholeness, the idea that through deep breathing, you can get a greater sense of the unity or wholeness of the psyche and experience dimensions that are not normally available. So he came to the abductions phenomenon with a larger sense of reality to begin with. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, he tended to end up working with witnesses who were far more open to having a transformative outcome from their encounter or their close encounter.
Can we talk about the Ariel Primary School case that was in Zimbabwe? Because I think John Mack went there and there was some strange things happening. But first of all, could we just say what did happen there?
Yeah, it was, I believe, 1994, I believe, probably September, almost just about coming up to that time. I sometimes get the dates confused, but it doesn't really matter. It's been over two decades. A private school in Zimbabwe, Africa, a town called Ruwa, R-U-W-A, was the kids had gone out on the playground for recess. It just happened that the teachers and staff remained inside for a staff meeting. And the students all went out the way they often did. It was a very interesting coincidence. And again, in the sense in which maybe these events are in some way, they happen with a sense of almost destiny. In any event, the kids were out playing their normal games, and a few of them noticed a glint of light off in the distance between the trees. And as they paid attention to it, they noticed that it was an object of some kind. It was an apparent craft of some shape they'd never seen before. And as it hovered and came down onto the ground, the students saw, I'll use the term aliens, simply because that's the most, I could call them creatures or simply beings that were not, they were humanoid, arms and legs, but not did not appear to have human features, had very dark, cool, reflective eyes, large eyes. It was the eyes that got the attention of the students. A young student named Emily Trim, only 8 years old, had the presence of mind and the lack of fear to approach. I don't know how close she actually became or came to this being. She wasn't threatened. And she found herself, her head was suddenly filled with images, and she felt that she was communicating. She didn't know the word telepathy, but she and several other students said that they communicated with the beings. When John Mack, the UFO researcher we've been discussing, got word of this case, he got on a plane from Boston and went to Africa and interviewed the students separately and worked with them to try to do good forensic investigation. He said, when you felt this communication, what do you mean? Was it with words? And the students, when he individually interviewed them, said, no, it was in our conscience. And they used the term conscience. And he translated that as consciousness. He said, in other words, the communication was between your mind and theirs. Exactly. That's exactly what it was like. They didn't know phrases like telepathy. So, and part of what they were getting, the communications, were that the Earth, that human beings needed to take better care of the planet. The term that Emily got was that we must not get too technologized, her own word. We must not get too much technologized, not too much into technology. Don't depend so much on that. We're going to overload the ecology, that kind of thing. Again, these are school children. Their curriculum did not consist of a lot of indoctrination about climate change. This is a small private school in Africa. So it was remarkable. 60-some students saw this this craft and saw these things. They went back inside and told the teachers. The teacher said, oh, you kids, you're always coming up with something. But then they turned on the radio and found out that throughout Zimbabwe, some kind of craft had been seen, and they were being called into the radio station. A reporter for the BBC said he had been in war zones. He had never studied a case that was as stressful as this case. And it was this reporter who called in John Mack. And by the way, the children drew, made drawings, crayon type drawings of what they had seen, and they did it independently. And I feature these in the book because they were not exactly the same, which is actually a good standard for their likely authenticity. If they all drew the same craft exactly, that would probably be a sign of some kind of coaching. But they drew similar craft and similar aliens, but according to their different perspectives, where they were standing on the playground. So it was the biggest mass sighting that I know of. And yet, it's a perfect example of how it nevertheless does not go beyond a few days' worth of reporting. There is a very good documentary, I think it's still available on Amazon Prime, called The Aerial Phenomenon, that I highly recommend. It shows John Mack interviewing the students and brings the entire sighting to life very well. And I have a chapter in the book called Morning in Zimbabwe.
And it's interesting you mentioned this thing about how the sighting happened at the same time all the teachers were in a meeting, as though the ETs planned it that way. But then they were giving this ecological message to children. You'd think it would be better to give it to the adults.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And it feeds into the debunker mentality. By debunker, I mean that individual who very often shows up in these debates. It's not just one individual. They present as skeptics. They say, no, we're open to this, but we're very skeptical. So we ask the hard questions. Well, I'm all for skepticism. I'm a skeptic myself. I don't try to take anything at face value, but I open myself to what people report, and I write it down, and I don't try to erase it or push it away. But there's a different kind of skepticism that very often just simply is committed to debunking this. They very often act in the name of science, but it's not a very scientific response. It's similar to the church coming to visit Galileo. So when the debunkers hear a detail, like the students were all out on the playground together and all of the teachers and staff just happened to be in a meeting, they'll say, oh, how coincidental. What a lucky break. The students just happened to be outside and there are no adults. Wouldn't you say the best explanation of that is the 60 children all got together and co-created a common made-up story? Well, at one level, that sounds reasonable if your goal is to explain it away at all costs, regardless of what the evidence is. But actually, no, it's not a very likely hypothesis. Can you imagine 60 kids on a playground agreeing? I mean, how would they stage such a thing? You can imagine three or four students claiming they went around a wall or out into the forest or out beyond the grounds of the school and saw something and came back. That could be. You'd want to talk with them individually, get their story straight. But when you talk about 60, 65 students, it is almost too good to be believed. And that's why the debunkers tend to have a field day. They say, oh, the students were all outside, but the staff were all indoors. But that can be interpreted in an entirely different way. Could there be a consciousness to this phenomenon that selected it precisely for the sake of speaking to a group of children? Who knows?
Wow, it's been great talking to you. We just about ran out of time. The book's called The UFO Paradox, The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, Amazon, Barnes & Noble's. It's available as a print book, an ebook, and also as an audiobook. Which I narrated myself, so I can prove that I did it and spent a lot of time in the studio getting it done. And I have a website, which I'd be glad to mention, just that the book can be ordered there, and that is thompsonatlarge.com, Thompson with a P, thompsonatlarge.com.
Fantastic, and thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's been great talking with you. Best wishes.
And that was an interview with Keith Thompson about his book, The UFO Paradox: The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. So there are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. And my website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. There was a report that one of the ETs seemed to run repeated stretches in slow motion, as if the scene were being replayed.
Exactly. One of the aliens or creatures would move forward step by step, but then would be, imagine an animation, a cartoon, in suddenly slow motion reverse. And then he, the alien...